Hello and welcome to Reasons to be Joyful. My guest this week is the comedian Rosie Jones, who is joy personified. She started her career behind the scenes in television as a researcher before turning her hand to stand-up. Since then, she's toured the UK, appeared on countless TV panel shows, and is a published author. So here's our chat. I hope you enjoy it.
Yeah.
Rosie, you and I first met in real life backstage at a charity event, and everyone was in the room. There were all these women, a really sort of strange bunch of women. I mean, real mix of women.
Yeah.
And the two of us were nattering in the corner, and they kept saying, "Can you come out on stage? Come on, you two." Because
no.
We have a mutual friend,
yes,
who got you singing opera.
Yes, Fee,
we love her.
A woman. So Fee is a great TV producer, and I've known her since before I was a comedian, when I was a little TV researcher. And she...
I love that, a little TV researcher.
Yeah. I'm only 5'1". I was tiny. And Fee rang me up last year and said, "Rosie, can you sing?" And I went, "Fee, I can't even talk." And she had faith in me, and I did opera lessons.
That was extraordinary.
Yeah, and cut to me on the stage of the Coliseum, live TV, comic relief, with four brilliant women who could sing a lot better than I could. But just like going out of my comfort zone and doing something that I never even imagined I could do was incredible.
I was crying, and I don't mean that in a patronising way. I was so overwhelmed because Fee is such a dear friend, and she told me that you were doing it, and then I watched you doing it, and I remember messaging you just going, honestly, it was incredible. But you always take yourself out of your comfort zone. Did you do that when you were a child?
Yeah. I think I always did. Basically, I had a mum and dad who, from a very young age, they learnt that if they said no to me, I will kick, scream, and do it anyway. And I think my disability is a reason for it. I've had cerebral palsy since birth. And I think definitely growing up in the 90s, I didn't have that positive representation of what it meant to be disabled. And that's quite isolated.
Of course it is.
Yeah, and I think if you're a woman, you normally have your mother or older positive role models. If you're non-white, you normally have all or part of your family who are the same. If you are queer, there are spaces as soon as you start drinking, you know, to get to your local gay bar. But in terms of disability, there isn't that sense of community. Like,
oh, that's interesting. I never thought of it as community.
Yeah, not because none of my family had a disability. No one in my school did. As I grew older in a seaside town, there wasn't any disabled spaces. And that's isolating, and definitely for me, I had to figure out a lot of that myself.
How did you do? I mean, so at school, how did the people at school, the teachers and the pupils, treat you, or how were they with you?
First of all, to be a little political, I went to school at the perfect time. Because if I went to school 5 years earlier, I probably would have been put in a disabled school. But when I started in the early 90s, they were phasing out disability schools. So I went to a mainstream school, but we had a Labour government, and therefore the funding was there for me. So I was able to have a teacher's aide, the wonderful Judith Larson, who was with me one-to-one for 7 years in primary school.
Oh, that's giving me goosebumps.
She was my best friend, whereas now, well, recently she's actually left education because of all the cuts. By the time she left, she had to look after 5 or 6 severely disabled children in one go. And that means she's exhausted and they miss out on her rightful education in a mainstream school.
So you've got a locked... I mean, she was there for you, which is vitally important to have that person to hold your hand.
Yeah.
When you left school and you started in a little TV person, as you said, little TV researcher, and you got into writing and everything... Did you have those people there then? Were there people holding your hands then?
No, not really. And even quickly back to school, Judith was incredible. The teachers were amazing. But in terms of the other students, I was never bullied, but because I always went into every room, every situation, going, "Hello, I'm Rosie, I'm disabled, but I'm just like everyone else." I was loud, I was funny.
You surprise me, Rosie.
Yeah,
really?
No way.
Loud and funny.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And that would have always been me. But thinking back on it, it was definitely created as a defence mechanism in order for people to see my personality more than they saw my disability. So it's always been up to me to almost apologize for who I am.
Oh, that's interesting.
Rather than me just entering a new space and being able to just be me.
Did you do that then? So there, I asked you about when you went to work and people were holding your hand. Did you do the loud Rosie, the funny Rosie, because you wanted that for them to see that first again in the workspace?
Yeah, definitely. And again, I really benefited from television. I started in TV in 2011 and I was part of the Channel 4 Diversity Scheme, which was incredible because for me living in Yorkshire, I could not have afforded to move down to London and get a part-time job as a runner. So just doing this year-long scheme put me in a production company and gave me stability. But even then, even in 2011, I was the only disabled person in a production company of about 150 people.
So again, isolating. Must have been very isolating.
Yeah. So therefore, schooler had to go, "Hello, I'm Rosie, and the loud one, and the one that will crack jokes in the kitchen." And I often mask what I need with a joke. So, for example, I love tea and coffee, but I cannot make it because me with hot liquid, it's a bloody disaster. So I normally, when I worked in an office, I'd get to the kitchen, I'd hang around, I'd chat to people.
It's a nice way to meet people.
Yeah, and then I go, "Oh, love, do you mind pouring that for me?" And hopefully, in my mind, they will never go, "Oh, I'm helping the disabled woman." It was like, "Chat, chat, chat, pour my drink. Oh, could you carry it to my desk? If I carried it, it'd be a fucking disaster." Little joke, chat, chat, chat. Yeah. Whereas I never felt like I could enter the workspace and go, "Hello, I can't make tea. Could someone help me?" I've always used comedy to get what I need.
That's so interesting because one of the things, and I'm fully aware, and I did check with you, we could talk about it, was all the online abuse that you get. Yeah. So it's all well and good in person for you to be the loud, the funny one, the one that everybody now has completely fallen in love with. But then you did Question Time and the online abuse that you got and you get, which I didn't realise, but you get all the time, you can't be loud and funny in print, can you really?
No.
So those people are just foul.
Yeah. And you mentioned question time, and that is a fascinating one because I think I got a lot of that abuse because I wasn't funny, because I didn't have that armour of she's just a happy, lovely, funny lady.
Oh, my word.
Yeah, it was, he's an angry woman who was very clearly anti-Tory and Labour leaning.
So you think that was the reason that people went on, that was the first level.
Yeah.
And what they then went on was the physical level of she's a disabled girl.
Yeah.
Right.
So I've watched what I said back many times and I agree with it wholeheartedly and I went to town on the Tory government and how they treated disabled people because I think it's absolutely disgusting and I think a lot of right-leaning people got angry at what I said and if you get angry but you may not have the intelligence to say your side, you go for the physical, you go for the disability. So that's why I got that abuse.
It's just, for me, when I think of you, and that's why we wanted you on this podcast, because it's reasons to be joyful, you like to spread joy.
Yeah.
And yes, you have your beliefs, and you're not quiet about how you think. No. I mean, the TV shows that you've done are so funny.
Yeah.
I mean, so funny. From the stand-up stuff to the, you know, to mock the, all of those things. But your own shows now that you've been doing, I mean, Trip has properly... I mean, there's my favourite clip that you have on your website, which if I think, it just makes me laugh thinking of it. When you went, most people climb to the top, but I can't be bothered. Did you remember? I mean, you know, you just, you take the piss out of yourself happily.
Yeah.
But you are about spreading laughter because laughter actually is important. And it's very important to you, isn't it?
Oh, hugely. And I think it's what we've been saying of laughter and humour is very disarming. So you can get your point or your beliefs across with a joke. So a lot of people, including my nana, say to me, oh, you should be a politician or, oh, you should be a lawyer. You can change the world. And my argument right now is I think I can make more of a difference in comedy because if a person watches my shows or comes to my comedy shows and they leave thinking that was great, I've had a great night, but now I'm thinking about how I might not use a certain kind of ableist abuse at the pub, or maybe I will vote differently at the election. I am slowly changing the world one joke at a time.
How important is laughter to you, though, for you to laugh?
Really good. Mainly I'm laughing at myself. When I told my best friend that I wanted to become a comedian, she said, "Why? No one will ever find you as funny as you find yourself." And actually, that's true. I did a show on Saturday, a talk show, and I had to stop for like 3 minutes because I made myself laugh. But for me, if I find something funny, I go, "Great, hopefully other people will too." And yet, like, you know me, day to day, I just chat to people, I joke, I find the joy in life.
You've got funny bones. And I think, you know, we were talking earlier, before we started recording, about people that we both think are just funny.
Yeah.
They're funny. Yeah. Tom Allen, funny. Yeah. Rob Beckett, funny.
Yeah.
You know, and there are many others, so apologies for not mentioning them all. But funny bones. And I think it's something that it's a weird thing to say. I think it's something you're born with.
I do, and when I think about my childhood, it was always around the kitchen table, Mum, Dad, me and my little brother, and we'd eat for hours.
You'd eat for hours?
But even after we finished all the cheese and all the bread, we'd be sat there laughing and talking.
Oh, how lovely.
And that is still my favourite thing to do, just to go for dinner with a few friends and sit there and laugh and laugh and laugh.
Do you know what the one thing I've picked up from that is you obviously come from a very posh family because you ended with bread and cheese at the end of the meal. I was never a time when I was a child that we had bread and cheese at the end of the meal.
Actually, we were a little bit posh, but only on a Friday.
Oh, you had bread and cheese on the
and we wouldn't end on bread and cheese. That would be the whole meal.
Oh, I see. That's the whole meal.
We'd have bread, cheese, olives, like a picky bit.
Oh, that's my favourite type of meal.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go to the TV shows that you're making. So documentary is coming out in a few weeks about ableism.
Yeah.
Now, there are a lot of people who have maybe heard that word for the first time or read that word and don't know what it means. So for people who don't know what ableism is, can you explain it and then just tell us a bit about the documentary? Because it's a big documentary for you.
Yeah.
It's from the heart.
So ableism is simply when you discriminate against somebody because of their disability. And it's interesting, if you ask someone on the street what is racism, what is sexism, what is homophobia, they could tell you immediately. Whereas when I say, "What's ableism?" people aren't sure, or they say, is that really a thing? Or they say, have you made that up? And I, as a disabled person, only learned that word about 5 years ago. But, and then, in hindsight, I took a lot of ableism on myself, and I blamed myself.
Blame yourself?
Yeah, so for example, a big example of ableism is at least once a week I will call a taxi. The taxi will park up and then I'll walk towards it and the driver will go, you're not getting in.
What?
You're drunk. And I will say, no, I'm not drunk, I got cerebral palsy.
And once a week this happens to you?
Once a week. At least, and the driver will drive away. And that has happened to me at 3 a.m. in the middle of London. I can't tell you the amount of times I've been stranded and I felt like I was in danger. As a woman and as a disabled person, and before I knew what ableism was, I would go, well, yeah, it makes sense. I do look drunk, it's not their fault. Whereas now I go, no, taxi companies need to educate their drivers on different levels of disability. I didn't even find it with the core ableism. So if I get shouted a slur in the street.
You still get slurred?
Yeah, yeah. What?
Really?
Usually at night. Usually.
This is just horrible.
Yeah. And again, before I knew what ableism was, I would go, well, yeah, well, they don't really know what a disability is. So I'd eat up all the ableism. And luckily, I got a great network of friends and family out there, but it takes its toll.
Of course it does.
So I decided to do a documentary all about abuse and ableism because I think I've established myself as it's funny, comedian, is always happy, who just happens to be a little bit wobbly. And I think it's time for people to realise that whilst they am all of these things behind the camera, I am still getting abused every day. I am still getting discrimination about what I sound like and what I look like. And I think it's time for us to take ableism assume actually, as we take all other forms of discrimination.
I completely agree. I'm so sorry that that happens to you, because I just think it. There's no two ways about it. It's wrong. That's it.
Yeah.
Don't do it.
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
don't do it.
Yeah.
But also for you, going into the spotlight. So there you were, right? Because you were writing. We're going to talk about your books again in a minute as well. But there you were writing for TV, and then you put yourself out there. It, you know, nobody pushed you and said, "Right, you've got to do this." You put yourself out there. Did you have any concept then of what was going to happen, how it was going to roll? And I mean the good stuff as well as that horrible stuff.
I mean, I can't say this without sounding like an arrogant.
No, I asked you the question, so just tell me as it is.
I started stand up when I was 27, and around the time of when I was like 23, 24, a friend said to me, "You should do stand-up." And I said, "Yeah, I will, but not yet, because I'm not ready to be famous yet."
Oh, so you really knew what you were doing?
I knew, and it sounds incredibly arrogant.
No, it doesn't. To me, it doesn't sound arrogant. It sounds actually really bright and with it and very tuned in.
Yeah, and I just think, of course, there isn't a magic potion to be famous and successful. But definitely for comedy right now, I think you need a combination of, like we said, natural humour. And I knew I had that because I knew I could go into a new workspace or meet new people and make them laugh immediately. So I knew I had the humour and the confidence coming from TV. I knew how that side worked. I knew how to write a joke, how to pitch a show, how to act on the panel show in order to make sure that a lot of your jokes made the edit. So,
that's clever.
That experience, a third thing. Again, coming from TV, I had experience and a knowledge of the comedy industry, and I saw the new comedians coming up, and I knew no one was saying what I would bring to it, so I could even then see a rosy hole in the comedy world that I knew when the time was right, when I had the tools and knowledge and experience, I could fit myself into that. And my final component, which you know is huge in this industry, is I work damn hard. I've been a full-time comedian now for 6 years, and in that 6 years I can count on my two hands the totally free days I've had. Even when I have a day off, I'm writing a picture, mulling over a joke. So I worked them out, and when I was ready to become a, quote, famous comedian, I bloody put my mind to it, and I don't take anything for granted. So all of those elements I could envisage, even at 23, 24, going, yeah, I will be famous. Not yet, but when I'm ready. That was always a path for me.
Do you know, I didn't realise that we all... This is going to sound a bit odd. We all needed our hole filled with Rosie. But you know what I mean. No, you know what I mean. You know what I mean. So when I'm just saying about your writing, because, of course, you've written Edie, the books about Edie, three books and more to come.
Yeah, yeah.
So for people who haven't read Edie, get the books. I told you about my friend's little boy who is... precious and lovely, and those books are very important because he also has cerebral palsy and he's going to be 10 in November, and he's lovely and he loves you, but more so his mum loves you for what you were doing for him. At 9 years old, he sees you on telly. He's got those books. Yeah. So important, and to so many others. And it's taken too long for that, let's be honest.
Yeah.
But those books are so important to you as well, aren't they?
Yeah, so that comes back to my childhood when I need to stretch that. I had a great childhood.
You do? Well, you had the bread and cheese.
Yeah.
Bread and cheese!
Bread and cheese. But in hindsight, it was isolating, and a big part of it was when I turned on the telly, when I opened a book, there was nobody who looked or sounded like me. And I remember age five, I said to my mum, I want to write a book all about a little girl about
when you were five.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I just didn't want anyone else to feel as alone as I did. So I wrote Edie. I wrote the first book during lockdown, and out of everything I do, like probably the thing that I'm most proud of, and I love it. I do a lot of book festivals, and a lot of the children who come are disabled, who say, thank you for writing someone like me. And spoiler alert, the books also deal with queer identity, and at the end, Edie kisses another girl. So I then have a lot of girls and boys who come with their mum and dad and say, thank you, they read Edie and they were able to have the language to tell us that when they're older, they might want to kiss other boys are other girls. So that's a massive thing as well. But then I have a third group of children who are able-bodied and who come dressed as Edie, and they just go, "Oh, I like Edie because she's funny." And I think that group made me the most emotional, because when they were putting their Edie dungarees on that morning, they weren't thinking, "Oh, I'm dressing like a disabled girl." They were just going, "I want to look like Edie because she's amazing." So it's incredible to see how my little book will affect children and educate them and hopefully make them feel less alone.
Rosie, you know what you are? You are wonderful, and you call yourself the triple threat. There's many more threats there. There's more than just three. More than just three. Rosie Jones, thank you.
Thank you so much.
I hope you're enjoying the series so far. Remember to follow and subscribe to the podcast, please, so you never miss an episode. And find me on Instagram at Gabby Roslin for more podcast and joyful nuggets. We'll be back with Rosie on Friday for our show and tell episode. And I hope you can join me then. Bye for now.